You're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. This will all make sense when I am older. Someday I will see that this makes sense. One day when I'm old and wise, I'll think back and realize that these were all completely normal events. I'll have all the answers when I'm older, like why we're in this dark enchanted wood. Someday when I'm old and wise, I'll grow up and realize that all of this ain't bad. It's good. Growing up means adapting, puzzling at your world and your place. When I'm more mature, I'll feel totally secure, freaking out in motherfucking quarantine. I'm gonna run out of weed. See, that will all make sense when I'm older. So there's no need to be terrified or tense. I'll just dream about a time when I'm in my age of prime. 'Cause when you're older, absolutely everything makes sense. This is fine. Greetings to you, my quarantine kids and pandemic pals. It is your noble, faithful, muscular, powerful, masculine, beautiful, bearded host, D. Trussell, reporting in from a very secure compound in LA, where we have been told to shelter in place. Suddenly, we find ourselves in some kind of apocalyptic thriller. The news is non-different from every single disease-slash-zombie movie that I've ever seen, and the weird, beady-eyed politicians are getting real squirmy up there in a way that I've never really seen before. And if I wasn't someone who was actually in the movie, I think I would probably enjoy watching it. But the reality is, I don't get to lean into my previous self-destructive mode of being, because now I'm married with a one-year-old, so I don't get to get off on the possibility of dying or society falling apart, or to lean into the stupid fantasy of being a survivor wandering down the highway gathering, you know, I don't know, old bits of metal and trading them for ketamine that I bring back to my bunker. And I don't know why that's a fantasy, to live in a bunker with a big pile of ketamine. But if I didn't have a wife and a child, that's probably what I'd be doing right now. I'd be up to my neck in the K-hole, spinning around, pouring booze on the rising anxiety, and, I don't know, playing God of War over again. But that's not, I don't get to do that now because, you know, we got to get milk for the baby. How weird is this? The buttons aren't working anymore. You press the button and they bring you the food. You want milk, you go to the store and there's milk and eggs. It's all gone. Every single person that I rolled my eyes at who had chickens. I don't know if y'all ever did that, but you know when your friends got chickens, you're like, what's going on, Grizzly Adams? What else you got around here? You collecting rainwater? You gonna do that too? Are you okay? You know, you leave the prepper's house and you're like, oh boy. What's wrong with them? They're eating too much weed. Now I'm trying to remember who the fuck had chickens that I know, so I could contact them and see if they'd be willing to trade some eggs for some of the, I don't know, musical gear or something like that. No eggs? You can't bake, you know? We're okay. After one of the first creepy press conferences where Trump said he was putting Mike Pence in front of the pandemic, in charge of the pandemic, I ordered hundreds of dollars worth of food. And then I told my wife, and then she ordered a bunch of food. And so we find ourselves fairly well supplied. But still, some of this stuff, man, holy shit, we just don't have it right now. They're saying they might bring the National Guard in to help stock grocery shelves here. You know, I don't know. It's a very bizarre situation we find ourselves in, and I feel really lucky that I had this podcast on hand with Sharon Salzberg, who is an author, a meditation teacher, and exactly the sort of voice that I would want to broadcast out into the world at the moment. Remember, we recorded this prior to this becoming a pandemic. So if it seems as though we are ignoring the current reality, it's just this happened before this current reality was a reality. But nonetheless, I think you'll find there's many things that Sharon teaches that are very applicable to the present moment, specifically the idea of being kind and compassionate to yourself and to others, and that compassion and kindness is like a muscle that we can develop, that maybe you just don't start off as some kind of perfectly kind and compassionate being, but just like any other beautiful thing, it's something that you develop over time. We're going to jump right into this episode, but first, this. Much thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. Squarespace is the most powerful web creation service in the entire universe. This space used to be held by the Lordarians from the Quasneck sector of Ex-Tevalon, but as you know, they were supernovaed into oblivion. So now it's Squarespace, and let's face it, the Lordarians are dicks, and they're not afraid to slap you for no reason. So look, I'm not glad anybody got supernovaed, but if I had to choose, it would be the Lordarians. Regardless, Squarespace has all the tools you need to make a beautiful website. If you're in a hurry to get a website up right away, you can make a website in minutes with Squarespace. But if you want some deep, beautiful, incredibly complex, yet amazingly subtle website, a work of art like the one you might find over at DuncanTrussell.com, then Squarespace has all the tools you need to do that. From the basic necessities like a Squarespace website automatically sizes to any phone or device, to all of your online store needs, they've got a shopping cart function. They can handle all of that for you, to sending out mail to your subscribers. They can do that too. Squarespace has everything you need to get your online business going right away, but it doesn't have to be all about business, especially these days. You can just make a fun website like quarantinekids.com is available. So right now, head over to squarespace.com and you can try them out for free. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/Duncan and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, that's squarespace.com/Duncan, offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. My beautiful friends, here's some amazing news. I finally got my shit together and started updating my Patreon. So right now, if you head over to patreon.com/DTFH, you'll find that there's some new tiers. And if you stick around long enough, you can get exclusive DTFH sacred mugs. They're beautiful. You can get exclusive t-shirts that you can only get from subscribing to the Patreon. Also, you'll get hour-long extra rambling things, reports in from my bunker here during the pandemic, and lots of other stuff. Who knows what you're going to see on there? Maybe a human sacrifice eventually. I don't know how far left this thing is going to slide. Regardless, head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. Also, I can finally announce that my show on Netflix that I created with the brilliant Pendleton Ward is going to be out on April 20th. If you haven't seen the teaser for the show, you can find it on YouTube. I'll put a link at DuncanTrussell.com. Today's guest is a meditation teacher and an author. She's one of the most powerful spiritual leaders that I've ever crossed paths with, and has written a great many incredibly powerful, life-changing books. She's got a new book coming out, which is fantastic and certainly timely. It's called Real Change: Mindfulness to Heal the World and Ourselves. Right now, you can pre-order the book. And y'all, if you love Sharon, won't you please pre-order her book? These guests are so generous with their time, and it's so cool that they come on the show. And you can really, really help them out by pre-ordering books. I don't know much about publishing, but I do know that it has some kind of impact on the business side of things. I will have the link, the pre-sale link at DuncanTrussell.com, and I'd love for you to do what you can to order the book and to support Sharon. So now, without further ado, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Sharon Salzberg. Sharon, welcome back. It's so great to see you.
It's great to see you.
This is Losar. We're here on the Tibetan New Year, and I already got to be at a Tibetan temple, and now I get to be with you, who I consider one of the greatest Buddhist teachers around right now. Is it fair to say it's Buddhism that you teach?
It's fair to say it. I mean, I don't often express it that way because I think it's sort of universal wisdom, and I don't want like the B label to
right.
Scare
I get
people.
It. Does that sometimes I feel like kind of like people want you to compartmentalize yourself into something, don't they? Like they want you to say that, or yeah, I love that you're just saying yeah, I'm not that. But then sometimes I feel like if I say I'm not that, does that mean I'm not committing enough to Buddhism or to some path? You know, it goes, you know, because some people say, listen, you've got to like pick it and go for it and say that's what it is. Buddhism, Christianity, Islam. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, you know, I feel like I live kind of in a hyphenated reality. That's why people say Jew-Boos or Hindus or...
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, I see.
My first teacher was S.N. Goenka. I'd gone to India in 1970, and I began my first intensive 10-day retreat January 7th, 1971. That's where I met Ram Dass and Krishnadas and Joseph Goldstein and all kinds of people. And the first night of that retreat, Goenka said, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism. The Buddha taught a way of life.
Wow.
So that was like day one.
Wow.
And it just became like the foundation of my understanding. And
that's so cool. That's so true. He didn't know it would be... Yeah. That's not even what they called it then.
No, they don't call it Buddhism. We call it Buddhism. It was a Western notion, you know, some hundreds of years after the Buddha. So they call it the Buddha's teaching or the Buddha's way or something like that.
Wow, what a relief to hear that. I guess it's true with Christianity too. It wasn't Christianity at the time. There was a name for it. It was just some kind of way of being.
That's right.
That it maybe wasn't even that new necessarily. I mean, it's not like Buddhism didn't... This is also where I get a little confused about Buddhism is... the concept that it predates the existence of Siddhartha Gautama. Like that, the thing that was coming out of him, it's not like it wasn't already there.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's true. It's like the word Dharma, which is usually translated as the Buddha's teaching or the way, really means the laws of nature. So it's not like the Buddha made them up.
Right.
You know, he had a new... depth of understanding maybe or revelation, and he expressed them.
Well, to me, the implication of the pre-existence or the transcendental perennial philosophy sort of channeled through people means that we live in a world where at some point a new Buddhism or a new thing without a name, maybe it exists in the world right now, mm-hmm. could begin to be propagated, and that creates a situation of, I guess, what would you call it? Hopefulness? That at any given moment, the same epiphany that happens to the mythological or historic prophets could happen to a person. Mm-hmm. But it's something new, right? It's something that people haven't quite heard before in a certain way. But the difference is when these people in the past were talking about their epiphany, there was no internet, meaning that the transference of the data set will happen overnight. Do you ever think about that?
Not really. but I mean, I think, you know, certainly it's true that I don't think of, and we don't think of tradition as like a monument. It's like a river. It's always renewing and changing and being born again. Otherwise, it's dead, right? And what was so important for people like me 2,600 years later from the Buddha's realization is that he wasn't just describing a reality he'd glimpsed or even abided in. He had methods. He had a path where he said, you know, I'm a human being, because he's always talked about as having been a human being. I had some big questions about life, like, why is it so hard? And, you know, why do we suffer so much? And why is there change? And how do I cope with that? And it said that whatever answers he came to through the power of his own awareness. And so can we, whatever our deepest questions are. And so the whole point is pointing back to you always. And that's not considered selfish or conceited. That's really the whole point. It's like we marginalize ourselves. We say, oh, it's great for the Buddha sitting under a tree 2,600 years ago, but I live in LA. I'm busy. You know, I can't, I can't have any real understanding. And that's not true. The whole point is our own understanding.
This, to me, is that's exactly, I think, what for a lot of people drives them to take these very expensive trips to different parts of the world in the hopes that they're going to run into this person or that person or see you. I don't know if it was expensive, actually. I think in those days.
It wasn't that expensive.
But you took the classic trip to India. And sure enough, you met a great teacher and you became a tremendous part of a community of seekers because of that. And so, yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I love the idea because, you know, I don't want to fly to India. I would like to teleport to India. I don't want to go live in a cave. I like the idea that my home is a temple, being a father is a teaching, and that the just where I'm at right now is the Bodhi tree. But then the other side of me goes, yeah, it's spiritual bypass. You're just afraid to take the big leap, the big jump. And but you think so, huh? That LA can be the very same as the forest that Siddhartha Gautama left the palace to go into. Your work, your job. How could that be?
I do really believe that. I think it's a harder path, actually, to stay in LA than to go off to India. It wasn't expensive, of course, in those days, especially not the way we traveled.
You took
overland.
Sounds dangerous.
It was a little scary. But, you know, I do think it's the harder path because it takes a huge intentionality to make that real. It's one thing to say being a father is my path, and it can be. And it's another thing when you've got a deadline and your kid is screaming. Your kid doesn't scream, but...
Oh, never. You know, it's weird. I thought that was going to happen. Doesn't cry. He just laughs.
Yeah, it's because he's not sleep deprived. It's great. You know, he's not like the rest
of
us.
He screams.
But, you know, it's like... And all this, you have feel all this pressure, and someone else is really anxious around you, and you're picking that up. And it's like remembering in that moment, like, oh, yeah, I have a commitment to kindness, or I have a commitment to the present moment, or look at this, everything changes. It's not easy, but it's possible. And it's what is easy is to just talk about it. You know, I was teaching a class in New York, and someone rather charmingly said to me, or not so charmingly said to me, a lot of younger meditation teachers than you say we don't have to do regular practice, like a formal dedicated period of practice. We can just be mindful whatever we do, mindful stirring the rice, mindful, you know, washing dishes or whatever. So what do you say in like your dotage? And I said, well, I think hypothetically that's true. For me, that would just be a story I tell. If I didn't have like a regular practice, it's like strength training or something.
Right.
Let's make it real, you know, because when the rice is boiling over and the phone is ringing and this is happening and that's happening, it's not that easy. But if you've kind of steadily devoted some time to deepening awareness and compassion and things like that, it will be there for you.
Right. So, yeah, that, I mean, it would be a dream come true if just by being around weightlifters, you could get in shape.
Yeah.
That would be the best. All you would need is to be friends with someone who is in shape. You would need to run. You would need to exercise. That is something I really love about Buddhism, is that, or whatever you want to call it, is that there is action involved, a kind of action, which some people say is meditation. Some people say is metta, I guess, working out your compassion muscle or something like that. I heard Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche say something that I'd love to ask you about in this regard. He was talking about the feeling of coming home from work. And he goes, people sit on the couch and they go, phew. And it felt like he was implying that you don't need to come home from work and sit on the couch to go, phew. That feeling is the feeling of being human, but it's being covered up by all the stress. Almost like he was saying enlightenment is that, am I misunderstanding him? Is there an implication that through this practice, every moment in traffic, in chaos, I could be getting that experience that I get right when I relax on the couch at the end of a day?
No, I don't think you're misunderstanding that. I think that's, in a way, the whole point. If not continuously there, then we know how to return to it when we're in traffic or whatever. And now I'm thinking about what's in that moment of like, huh, you know, this authenticity, right? You're not putting on a show for anybody anymore. You're just being yourself.
Right.
You're relaxing, of course. And also, it's that sense of almost like collecting yourself. You know, we get so role identified. Okay, now I've got to educate people, or now I've got to do this, or I've got to do that. And then just like, okay, no, I'm just being, I'm just me.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so there's a lot in that moment. And I think certainly that sense of home can be something we have wherever we are.
Role identified. Wow, what a mess that is, huh? That's an insidious trap, isn't it? You don't even realize you've become role identified until it's way too late. And then there you are, trying to be the teacher or a dad or a husband or someone who doesn't want to be a dad or whatever it is. Role identified. That's almost blasphemy for some people to even imagine that the thing they are isn't just an identification.
That's right. Well, that's what, you know, when we meet people, that's what we say, right? What do you do?
Yeah. What do you do? Oh, well, I'm a fireman, or I do comedy.
Yeah,
well, I'm not sure if I do comedy, but I do podcasts. Well, I don't know. And yeah, then imposter syndrome sets in. And then do you ever get that? Do you ever think to yourself, am I really a teacher?
Yeah. I don't know that I get it so much anymore, although, you know, there's a certain level. It depends on who I'm thinking about as my own teachers, where it does seem ludicrous, but... You know, when I started teaching because one of my teachers told me to teach. So it was really the old-fashioned way.
Right.
And I was completely disbelieving. I thought, that's ridiculous. I can't do that. And this is a woman teacher, this woman named Deepa Ma, who I was leaving India. This was 1974. And I was leaving for what I was convinced was a very short trip back to the States, before I'd go back and spend the entire rest of my life in India. And I went to see her. She was living in Calcutta. I went to see her just to say goodbye and get her blessing for my very short trip home. And she said, when you go back, you'll be teaching. And I said, no, I won't. And she said, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. She said, yes, you will. I said, no, I won't. And then she said two things that were very mind-blowing. She said, you really understand suffering, that's why you should teach. Because I, like many people, had had a very tumultuous, traumatic childhood. And I never, certainly that's what drove me to India at such a young age, but I never thought of it as a useful thing, you know, in terms of helping others. And then she said, you can do anything you want to do, it's your thinking you can't do it that's gonna hold you back.
Wow.
And I left her place. She lived in what we would call like a tenement room up on the fourth floor. And I walked down that staircase thinking, no, I won't. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to go teach. And I came back and life unfolded. And I went to visit Joseph Goldstein, who I had met at my first retreat. It was the first summer in Boulder that Naropa Institute was opening up. Speaking of Trungpa Rinpoche, and Joseph was actually Ram Dass's TA.
Wow.
Joseph had run into Ram Dass in Berkeley, and Ram Dass was on his way to Boulder, and he was going to teach this mega class of like 1,000 people. And then he had these divisions, like the chanting division and the meditation division, and he asked Joseph if he wanted to teach the meditation one, and Joseph said yes. So,
wow.
Jack Kornfield was living down the hall. That's where we met, teaching a class of his own. And Joseph was so popular, he was invited to stay on for the second session, and I stayed on with him. And then we got invited to teach a month-long retreat, and that whole time, I thought, I can't. First of all, I was terrified of public speaking. I mean, I couldn't give a talk at all. So that was a 30-day retreat, our first retreat. And the format of our retreats is that there's like one formal lecture, like at night. And Joseph had to do them all, like for 30 nights. I couldn't do it.
Was there a time where you were just backstage, like, I'm not going out there? Or you just told him, I'm not going to get in front of people. It's not happening.
I was sitting in the back of the room. I mean, there was no backstage, you know, it's just like us, you know. Like,
okay. Sorry, I don't know why I thought you were at the Apollo or something like that.
No, we were at some
camp. What was the green room like?
Yeah, the green room, the snacks were extraordinary.
That's amazing, because I've seen you speak and you're incredible. So that's so beautiful.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. And like all these people would go up and yell at Joseph, like, why won't you let her speak? Why won't you let her have a voice? And he would say, it's not my fault. Don't talk to her. But I was terrified. What I was scared of was that I'd be speaking and my mind would go blank. And I would just sit there and look like a fool.
Yeah.
And then I remembered, this was long before I did intensive loving kindness practice. There is that one practice that has a really nice guided meditation called loving kindness. And I thought, maybe I could talk about that topic, because if my mind goes blank, maybe I can launch into the guided meditation and no one will know.
Yeah.
And so at home in Massachusetts, I have like piles and piles and piles of cassette tapes of me giving one talk, because the only thing I could do was talk about loving kindness.
So wait, when you say one talk, you mean like the same beats?
Yeah.
So like a stand-up routine,
yeah.
Except for, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's so smart. That's one of my favorite Bill Hicks quotes. He's a great comic. You know Bill Hicks, the comic? Sorry, I don't know. Of course, I'm sorry.
No, of course.
I don't know. One of his quotes is, your jokes are safety parachutes for when your improv isn't working. And knowing that you have like a, now that is a very controversial thing to say, because many comics would be like, yeah, right. Go look at like late Bill Hicks when he's all hammered on stage, quote, improvising. It's terrible. There's nothing funny about it. You can like trick yourself, you know, but still for you, wow, that's so smart, because you always have that to drop
that's
into.
Right. That's right.
That's your, there's certain comics where you know they're having a bad set because the joke. They have a joke that's designed to like life support their way out of like whatever terrible trap they got themselves into up there.
Right.
That's so you started doing that and then you became repetitive with it a little bit.
Yeah, quite a lot.
And did you start feeling in that repetition that something was like robotic, or that this was not, that you needed to evolve past just that?
No, it was all I could do, really. But then one day I sort of had a realization. I thought, you know what? Because loving kindness is about connection. That's its essence. And one day I realized they're all like about connection, all those talks. You know, it's like people aren't here gathered to hear me impart my expertise. They want a sense of connection. So they're kind of all loving kindness talks in a way.
Yeah.
And that was when I could begin to speak.
What's going on with us as humans that we don't see that? Why is that invisible?
Yeah.
It seems just from not that I'm clearly not an evolutionary biologist, but it seems to me a little bizarre that beings that are so deeply, deeply interconnected seem completely oblivious to that reality. Do you have any theories on that? Why are we blind to that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the why, but it's certainly true, and it's maybe getting worse. You know, like one of the things I keep reading about, which I find startling and amazing, is this kind of epidemic of loneliness, that more and more and more people are describing themselves as lonely, and not just here in the States. So you think, wow, look at that, because we are so intimately interconnected in truth.
I'm going to be real honest with you. When you mentioned connection just then, I don't know that I had actually connected with you. And in that moment, I looked at you and thought, oh, Sharon, hi.
Hi.
And then this other thing happened. It was like dropping into something.
Yeah.
And so the epidemic of loneliness is, I didn't know about that, but it makes sense. Maybe just because I remember the first time I saw you talk and you were talking about compassion, training to be compassionate. And I remember thinking to myself, what? You can get better at that. You train at that. That's a thing you work out at. Mm-hmm. Similarly with connection, and maybe there isn't much of a difference between the two. Maybe people just don't even understand that you don't just instantly, it's not mm-hmm. something that you can do just in the way that you can like fall asleep or something like
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty controversial in the West. Maybe training is not even the right word, although it's the word I use, but people seem to think that something like compassion is something you either have or you don't have. And if you don't have it, you're out of luck. Maybe you didn't get enough as a kid or whatever, but it's too late. And in the East, they would never think that, because qualities like love and compassion and connection are considered emergent properties of how we pay attention. Like in that moment.
Yeah.
When we're just here together and we're actually just together. That's a moment of real connection, because we're paying attention to one another. I'm not thinking about, oh, you know, what time is it going to end, because I've got to, you know, do my laundry or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And we're also not thinking, you know, does he like me? You know, like, I hope he likes me better than his last guest, you know. You know, I don't know who that was. So.
I do. It was Brendan Walsh. I hope you're listening, Brendan. He's a friend of mine. Okay. I'm joking. I mean, I'm not joking, but.
Yeah. You know, so that's why the word training comes in, because we know you can train attention. That's what meditation practice is. And the belief is that if you train your attention, all these other things will just blossom. You don't have to sit and think, I'm a miserable, hating person, and I have to get more loving. It doesn't matter what you think, because you're putting the pieces in place.
I love what you said about the idea that if you get to a certain age and you haven't achieved some ability to be a compassionate person, a good listener, someone who isn't selfish, all the qualities that are... We all applaud and look at as like, oh, that's the idea of a good person. I love that, like, there is this idea that if someone's gotten to that point, they're like, well, we have names for them. Well, they're sociopaths. It's a narcissist. It's a soulless thing. You know, I got on, I don't know how it happened. Maybe I was just Googling narcissism, but I ended up on this terrible mailing, Ask Quora narcissist mailing list, where people... I would get updates anytime anyone wrote a horror story about an encounter with a narcissist. And at some point, I began to feel really sorry for these narcissists, because they're universally hated. And like, just from the DSM-4 definition, they're like, it's like hating someone who has autism or something like that. Like they're irredeemable. There is this concept that, like, oh, there's no way for them to ever not be concerned with themselves. They're like a black hole. They're a gravity well of ego identification. And therefore, they should be, I don't know what, banished, pushed out of society. And there's all kinds of, just forget the narcissist or sociopath, just how many times have you been sitting listening to people talk at a cafe, just eavesdropping, and they're talking about that person. Can you believe them? They're awful. Well, I cut them out of my life, because the idea is, you're never going to, they're never going to come back. Wow. I love that. The idea that at any point in time, no matter how rancid you may be, there is an ability, if you wanted to, to connect.
I really do believe that. Any one of us might have come from some really disconnected places, you know, and renewed or came back and returned in a way.
Returned.
Yeah.
Because this is we're dealing with a country that's been at war for 93% of its history. We got so many people who are raising kids who have profound PTSD. PTSD manifests as, you know, a defense. Some people's parents are walking defense mechanisms. And then the kids learn that. Many of us have learned that. And I'm afraid to say I learned it. And both my parents have passed away. And I'm still terrified to say, oh, you know, I learned to be. I became a master of numb. Like, I can go so numb, so fast, ice cold, just glaciated human in moments. I used to be proud of that. I used to think that was a good quality that's in the world, like a superpower. Now I have a son. You can't go numb. You can't ice down in front of a toddler or a wife or anyone for that matter. But I think a lot of us are kind of like, well, that's all that's left.
Well, you can't ice down or freeze in front of a toddler. Certainly, I think plenty of people have, which is why the toddler, you know, grows up thinking that's the way to be. I mean, you also remind me of something I read about in this book about the stress reaction and how people always used to say fight or flight, and that now they've added freeze.
What?
Yeah, so there's three common responses to incredible stress. And by incredible stress or responses, I mean there's always stress of some kind, but when the resources we have within don't seem adequate to meet the stress that's coming our way, it's fight, flight, or freeze. And we're used to fight or flight. Freeze is now considered one of them. And I was really happy because I, too, am a type, you know, where I'm more likely to freeze than fight my way out or flee. And so I thought, oh, good, you know, I'm being included. But it's a huge pattern.
Freeze.
Yeah.
It does, and obviously, it's not a literal freeze. That means numb down. It means just like drop out of wherever you're at.
And it's like disassociate. And it's better that way.
There's in Watership Down. They had a great name for when the rabbits see the headlights of a car. Thrall, I think, is what they called it. Or they had a cool name for it where they froze up with the headlights of the car coming. And yeah, I think, it almost is like this is not only have many of us just frozen, but we've sort of come up with an idea of like, well, this is just how it is to live. You sort of, you're here, you're not really here. And you just stay not here until you die. And then you're really not here anymore. And then that's a human life. Because for a lot of us, you know, growing up, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Where are you going to go? You're six. What are you going to get in the car? You're going to drive away? Mm-hmm. You're going to find a job somewhere? Mm-hmm. There's no escape. So what are you going to do? You can definitely aren't going to fight a 190-pound human. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I get it. You just go to the just go to the ground, freeze up. And that's where we're at. Well, not you. But I think some of these frozen people, are they the ones saying that that's loneliness? Maybe they're not even lonely.
Well, that's interesting.
Is the definition of loneliness changing where it's just people just feel generally numb?
That's very interesting. I'll really have to think about that. Maybe that's so. I mean, I've only thought about it in kind of sociological terms, like the things that used to bring us together. Like you went to a temple this morning.
Yeah.
People don't often do that anymore, necessarily.
Right.
Or, you know, the classic book about it was called Bowling Alone, about the dissolution of bowling leagues, where, you know, ways we just used to come together and have a sense of community there. They're not so prevalent anymore. For some people they are, of course, and other people are just dying or they've died. And so how are we going to find each other? And we have to find each other.
how are we going to find each other? I mean, I think both of us have I know sometimes, because I travel and do stand up and I have to go out at night to do stand up. And a lot of times I am a recluse. If I can stay in, I stay in. I like it. And I recognize like, oh no, this is bad. If I look at it, it's like taking a shower. It's like socially going out is like taking a shower. If you don't do it long enough, you know, you get a little stinky.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's just like the anxiety, man. It's like, you know, being around people when you're out of practice is just deeply anxiety provoking. Opening your heart to other people. This is why I don't do LSD. When I was younger, I would just like take acid, go to the mall, watch people. I can't do it anymore because it opens your heart. And you're around a person and you just see the pain. And it comes wrecking balling into you. You're looking at a person you've never met in your life and seeing like, oh man, you're not doing good. I'm never going to meet you. I certainly can't come up to you with my eyes completely dilated while you're at dinner with your family and be like, are you okay? But you see it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you cross that barrier? There's no way. I mean, we're so sequestered. I don't want to bug anybody. I don't want to bother anybody. I mean, literally people are laying on the street and we walk right by them, much less passing someone with a frown on their face or who seems sad or upset. How do you even cross that boundary, Sharon?
Well, I mean, for me, the most important state is the inner state. What you do externally will depend on the circumstance. You know, it's like you probably are not going to walk up to every person lying on the street and say hello, you know. But it's the internal feeling of like that person's life has something to do with mine. That seems really critical. And we don't have that either.
No one wants to even hear that.
Yeah.
What are you, a socialist? Are you a socialist, Sharon? Is that what you've come to? Socialism?
No, because I'm not saying you have to give them money, even, for example. But in our hearts, we have got to recognize this person as a person.
It's easier to give them money. But it's easier to give them money.
Well, I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do, but I think in terms of a genuine sense of connection, that's what's got to happen.
And by the way, when I was doing the Tucker Carlson interviewing Sharon Salzberg or something, I was joking. You know, I think it's like a wild thing that we even live in a world where the term socialism, which is the act of being social, is considered one of the great mistakes you can make. It's like getting a disease. It's like athlete's foot politically. You've broken out with socialism. Wow, man. God, I'm itching today, man. I've got socialism all over my body. And this seems to really mirror what you're saying about loneliness. If we live in a country where socialism is considered abhorrent, then wouldn't loneliness be a natural result of that? I mean, social, we want to be around. It's social. It's like we're social animals. But the term socialism, which would be the practice of being a social animal, is forget it. You're not getting elected if you're a social animal. You know?
Well, I'm also not running for office, thankfully enough. But
well, maybe thankfully for you, but for the rest of us, we would love it if you would. But do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like this is the country we're in. And I'm not beating up on America or anything like that. I just like, you know that a lot of people are like watching Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist. And they're like, no, oh my God, no. So it feels like what you're saying is all the political isms and stuff is great, but first, you've got to like de-thaw a little bit, start making these connections.
No, it's true. I mean, even, you know, sometimes if I go into a company or an organization to teach, one of the questions I ask people to ponder is, How many other people need to be doing their job well for you to be able to do your job well? Because we feel like we're all alone, right? And it's a dog-eat-dog world, and no one's helping me, so I'm not going to help anybody else. But what's the reality? You're counting on someone cleaning that room, right?
Yeah.
And you left it like a pigsty the night before, but you're counting on it. Or that operating theater, you're counting on it being sterilized, and you're counting on, we all are, or the roads and the bridges and getting somewhere, getting to work. It's like we live in an interdependent universe, and we don't acknowledge that very often. So if we don't wake up to that, then we don't want to contribute. Like, why should I contribute to the roads, you know?
Yeah.
Things like that. And it's crazy because there's not a way to survive that if it just goes on and on and on and on.
It's completely unsustainable. I mean, you can't, forget the roads. In my own house, sometimes if I'm in a particularly dark, selfish, compressed state, you know, I'll like leave like food on the counter. I won't even think about, you know, it's like, and then someone's cleaning it up that's not me. And that does not work at all. Let me tell you, in a marriage, that does not work at all. Oh, if only it did. It doesn't work, but much less in a society. But it almost feels like we've all been trained since, you know, we could watch TV at the very least to like not think about who's fixing the roads, to not think about who's cleaning our room, to not think about the person that you were just a jerk to at wherever you were buying the thing is going home that night to take care of their sick parent.
That's right.
No one's saying this stuff. I mean, I love conspiracy theories. I could talk about Hollow Earth all day long. But if you want to, it's for a different podcast. But if you want to talk about the grand conspiracy, it's that to me. Why is this not taught in school? Just a basic thing. Oh, you know the janitor. Guess what? He feels.
Yeah.
He has to buy money to eat. No one wants to even, what is that? It's like, is that suppressed data? Is that, or is that some kind of like dark Jungian, like, or like a gestalt that's springing up out of like the way we're running society right now, that there's an implicit censorship the moment you start saying, you know, there's someone who's going to wash your dishes after you eat today. People are like, shut up, social justice warrior. I'm trying to enjoy my pie. By people, I mean me. I don't want to hear it. It's annoying. Is it, what is it? Is it conspiratorial? You have a new book coming out about this very thing. And when you told me about this book, I thought, oh boy, I don't know, man. to dive into that is really courageous.
A little tricky.
And risky.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, the book is about mindfulness, loving kindness, and social change. And I include, by the way, art as a means of social change.
Oh.
So I have a lot of interviews basically with playwrights and artists of different kinds, as well as striking fast food workers, you know, trying to get minimum wage extended to $15 an hour, and people doing all kinds of work, immigration attorneys. And I have made a strong connection with the Parkland community in the last couple of years. So I have a few students, some teachers. I've taught there, and I've led retreats for that community. And so there are all kinds of people in the book, which makes me very happy. You know, it's, and they are really heroes, all of them, and they're not the super famous people that we might know about. And I just think they're terrific. And it's about things like interconnection. Like, it's a few things. One is like a vision of agency. I'm not going to just sit around and bemoan how the world is so terrible when I'm on Twitter. You know, I'm going to like do something, even if it seems like a small thing.
Wait, you mean rather than just like throwing out tweets?
Yeah.
You mean doing something a little bit more
than
typing into your computer?
That's right.
Going that extra step.
Yeah, a little bit extra.
So Instagram.
Could be. And then it's about, because it, I think we also live in a time where people are very impacted and feel often helpless. And so that idea of agency is really important. And I talk about, I have a chapter on moving from anger to courage and a chapter on moving from grief to resilience and chapter on interconnection, a chapter on...
Can we talk about the anger to courage
chapter?
Because
sure.
This is, you know, I think a lot of people are just pissed off in the most, in terrifying ways and in the extreme ways. And, you know, it's not... Even talking about activism now is considered... Maybe don't even talk about it. You know, like it's annoying. We just stop. There's nothing that can be done. And then this like deep anger is building.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we have a democracy. They're supposed to steam pressure valve that anger so we don't have like violent revolutions. So how do you convert anger into courage? Because the real problem is anytime anyone really angry starts lecturing us, even if they're right, a lot of us are like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to get lectured.
Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm.
so mad.
Mm-hmm.
I have jokes that I do that I've learned how, that if I do them with even the slightest hint of anger behind it, they don't work because people feel like I'm like preaching up there mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it sucks. But if there's like real love behind it, the joke was funny in it.
It's,
my friend calls it the spirit of play.
Yeah.
So how do you... do this conversion, this I would love to learn this alchemy.
Okay, well, there's also a chapter on joy, remembering joy, because there are lots of reasons we get lost in anger, and that's one of them. And
you mean lack of joy?
Yeah, or not lack of appreciation of joy. It's like the small things that seem great we disregard because we're either too guilty or we're too consumed with outrage or something like that. And then we get depleted, you know, we can't go on. And I also think, you know, activism doesn't just mean like protesting. That's why I included art. And I also include a person-to-person change in relationship.
Okay.
You know, it's not just vast social systems. It's like,
oh.
It's basically an expression of our deepest values.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Right. Well, it's sure easier to think about the, you know, grand social scheme than to just think about the fact that you haven't opened up to your wife.
That's right.
About the way you feel for a little bit.
Yeah.
We just did that.
Uh-huh.
It was rough. We went through a rough patch. And then a few days ago, we were just laying in bed. And we both just started telling each other how we felt, the truth. And now it's the best. It was amazing. Like, it was just, we and all the things that we were afraid to, we were both like, I feel that too. I feel that too. It was amazing. But I've never would I have thought that was social change.
Yeah, well, I'll call it social change. Yeah.
Wow. Huh. It makes it so much more manageable. Because I always just think of like, man, that Gandhi movie. When I think of social change, I think of that Gandhi movie where they didn't even use an Indian to play Gandhi.
Right.
But aside from that, just, you know, the marches.
Isn't he half Indian?
Oh, is he?
I think Ben Kingsley is.
Good God. Hold on.
You have to Google it?
No, I'm going to cut that out so I don't look like the biggest idiot on earth. I'm not cutting it out. I'm leaving it. What do I care? Sorry, Ben Kingsley. I know you listen to this podcast quite regularly. We're real good friends. Taught him how to act, actually. In my mind, it's a big thing. Big, big, big. So big that I just don't have the even slightest ability I just can't imagine doing anything like that. Like really making the big waves like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Greta Thunberg, all those people, you know, you're just like, oh, that's out there. But this thing that you're talking about, that's one of the most empowering things I've ever heard,
mm-hmm,
maybe,
mm-hmm.
Which is like, oh, right, of course.
It could just be like, is this, could it even be walking the dogs more? Whoa.
I think that's part of it. And for some people, of course, that's their arena, you know, like, could Martin Luther King Jr. have done something else? I doubt it. You know, that was just his space.
Right. That's his karma, yeah. Where he landed. And also, I'm not sure things at home were that great for him sometimes. It seems like there was some
apparently
tumult.
They weren't. Yeah.
Yeah. So that to me is that I can get behind. Because it's, for one, it's not even, there's no politics to finding harmony where you live.
Yeah.
That's not a political situation. That's just common sense. And the idea that also by doing that, you're simultaneously in some, I guess, infinitesimally small way, a little droplet of peace in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, wow, that's so beautiful. And like, I've heard versions of it, but that one really sunk in. Huh. Wow. Huh. Wow, that's cool, Sharon. I really like
so
that.
And you're clearly a great parent, you know, and it's coming from somewhere, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm a great parent. I'll be honest with you. I want to be a great parent. Like, I have that intention in me. But I don't, you know, from hanging out with you and Ram Dass, and by hanging out, I mean being able to listen to you teach and read your books, I feel like my wife and I, what the advantage we've got is that we can have that moment where we really open up to each other and we, you know, but my wife and I did not come from a place where we should be, where we know how to do marriage or know how to do, you know, do that. Cause no, I mean, my mom was divorced and remarried 3 times and, you know, most people I know are divorced. You know, it's like compassion.
Yeah.
Like, how do you just know how to be married?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost impossible, you know, and it's difficult to live with anybody. Then add a child, you know, here's an example. We went yesterday to walk the baby around the park in his wagon and it was a beautiful day. And it's great because we're getting along now. It's really sweet. Everything's real poignant and sweet. It's the spring. The baby loves the wagon, but he's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to get something to eat. And I made the wretched mistake of being like, why don't we just stop at this Thai food place? You don't give a baby Thai food.
Yeah, what can he eat?
But Aaron, we looked on the menu like, well, there's something there for me. Anyway, the point is, the beautiful day suddenly turns into the child having an allergic reaction to peanuts, we think. Face turned red. He's coughing. We're seconds away from calling 911. So how do you learn to deal with that level of instantaneous shift into, oh, what a beautiful day to, oh my God, am I going to lose the greatest love I've ever experienced in my life over peanut sauce? You know, this creates a lot of stress on top of just living with another human being. And so to me, like, imagining that the ability to harmonize those situations in a way that is at least has the intention of love,
mm-hmm,
is actually social work.
Yeah.
Is actually helping society in some way. I can't tell you how invigorating an idea that is.
I am so happy. Yeah, no, I really do believe it. You know, that it's funny when everyone says something to me like, I'm allergic to shellfish or I'm allergic to strawberries. I say, how did you find out? Because it's got to be a bad story, right? Like, I ate a shrimp and I passed out, or, you know, it's got to be a bad story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah,
there's that level to it. You know, like, maybe it's good you're discovering that. This is something that.
Oh, you know, right. You're right. Well, yeah. you know, we, that's right. We, you know, that's one thing for sure is like, now we kind of know something. Also, you know, after the baby was fine, you know, everything was fine. But I was thinking like, how many babies right now aren't fine? Mm-hmm. Like how many kids are like having to go to the ER right now because of, you know, because of this situation. But this, to me, there's like a, you know, that, I would never in a million years want to be a Messiah, a Buddha, a Jesus. I would for a day, maybe. It'd be fun to wander around for a day being like that level of a being. But I think over time, I would just be like, I want to go play video games, have a beer, and like, you know, I don't know, hate watch Sean Hannity or something. You know, I wouldn't want that life. But the idea of being a pixel, a little tiny part of an enlightened being in like a movement in society that didn't hinge on saving the ice caps or lowering fossil fuel emissions, or but was more based on, can you figure out a way to be with the people you're with right now that have caused you so much trouble, or that you've caused them so much trouble, in a whole new way? I think it's impossible for sometimes, though. Don't you think it's impossible? Is it impossible? Like, some situations seem untenable, you know, horrific, you know, no way out. Like, just what you were saying earlier about the whole of society depends on a collapse of the circumference of our awareness of the suffering of other sentient beings. Mm-hmm. What you're proposing is a really sweet way of saying we have to have some kind of revolution.
Mm-hmm. I think it is rather sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because it is like a revolution of consciousness. And, you know, I mean, I think it's also, it's not impossible. I mean, there's some situations that may be impossible, but I think the freedom of heart to really care about somebody and include them doesn't mean you're going to stay living with them, or you're going to hang out with them, or you're going to not fight their agenda. You know, not, we have that notion that love is a kind of passivity or something.
Yes.
And it's really not so. So I'm not saying like every relationship needs to be, you know, endured or something like that.
Right.
But inside, within ourselves, we can be free. We don't have to have other people define us. We don't have to believe utterly their story about us. We don't have to be lost in projection. We don't have to have a feeling that because things were a certain way yesterday, inevitably, definitely, they will be that way today. If we are awake, you know, certainly we can be different. And if a situation is actually doesn't seem amenable to change, and it's terribly painful, and it's limiting us and making our lives smaller or frightened, it's fine to go. That doesn't mean that you have no love in your heart.
Right. It can be done lovingly.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be done in some dramatic, dark, you know, vengeful way. There's a loving way to revolt.
Yeah.
Loving revolution. I just, only because I love you and I feel comfortable with you, I like that idea, but I have to say, and I want that to be the way. But it's like, isn't that a pipe dream? Look at France, the firefighters setting themselves on fire while the police attack them because of pension. Look at all the revolutions that happen all over the world. And now, in mass, as people begin to really wake up to the reality of the distribution of wealth, how do we do this peacefully? How do we do it lovingly? And also, are you saying that there's a possibility for loving violence?
Yeah, acting violently out of a place of love?
Yes.
I mean, I think talking about pipe dreams, you know, it's like, you know, certainly there's there's the idea of forceful action. We know there's such a thing as tough love, right?
Yes.
We know there's such a thing as fierce compassion. You may, first of all, you're working toward having compassion for yourself as well as for somebody else. It's not just all one direction. And in that balance, which is hard to find, you may decide you need strong boundaries. You need to be intense. You need to be fierce. You need to take strong action. I think when you say, you know, is there such a thing as loving violence, there's every possibility of deluding ourselves. Mm. Like, there's a story that actually happened to me when I was living in India way back when that I've heard like 50 other versions of, you know, as though they happened to other people.
Yeah.
And that was, I was with a friend, and we left Bodh Gaya, which is a very peaceful, holy place, to go to Calcutta. And coming back from Calcutta to get to the train station in Calcutta, there was something happening on the street, like a riot or something like that. You know, we couldn't get a car, we couldn't get a cab. So we got into a rickshaw, and in Calcutta, in those days, I don't know about now, rickshaws were not like men on bicycles. They were men running and pulling this cart. Oh, yeah. You know, so we got into one of those because it was the only way we could get to the train station. And so he's going down these back roads and these alleyways and things like that. And at one point, this very large, very drunken man comes out of the shadows and grabs him, stops him, and pulls at me, like to pull me off the rickshaw. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to be raped. I'm going to be killed. This is the end. And then the friend that I was with managed to push him away and get the rickshaw guy to start running again. So we got to the train station, got on the train, got to Bodh Gaya, and I was very shaken still. And I said to one of my teachers, this man named Manindra, I told him what had happened. And he said, oh, Sharon, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have taken your umbrella and hit that man over the head.
Yeah.
Which... is basically saying, you know, be strong, like, and yet we can think we have all the loving kindness in our hearts and not. And so it's very tricky terrain. I just, I don't think about it in those terms because it's too tricky, but I do think about strength, strong action, and that a loving space doesn't have to lead to meekness and, you know,
wow. This is one of the, I'm so glad we're talking about this because I think it is the trickiest of terrains, because how easy to trick yourself into imagining that your aggression and violence had some spiritual intent behind it and therefore was justified.
Yeah.
How simple to imagine that. But, and I guess this is just a discernment, a subjective discernment. You have to figure that out on your own.
Yeah.
I mean, because you know when you're in love. You know when you're loving.
Yeah.
Right? Don't you just know? And can you trick yourself? But then that being said, think of how many people, I'm asking you, how many people trick themselves into thinking they're feeling love when they aren't. But is it a feeling? You know, is love a feeling? I'm sorry, you're blowing my mind here, so I'm just trying to like decode what you're saying, imagining lovingly hitting someone with an umbrella. I think it could be done.
Yeah.
I've been to dominatrixes now that I think about it. I'm sorry.
Well, there's that too. I mean, this is the modern world. We're not talking about like some quaint little Indian village.
Yeah. But I, the reason I'm asking you this is because in my own, you know, in my mind, sometimes when I look at the world and I see what's happening, I get real nervous thinking, I don't know if protests are gonna be enough ultimately. Right now, things are great for some people, but they sure ain't great for most people. And people are getting mad. And then that gets me really creeped out because the last thing I want my child to experience is a violent revolution, the collapse of society, the fragmentation of society because of, you know, whatever inequality on such an overt, massive level that people could. I think one of the things all of us should be kicking around in our mind is, what does that look like? What would it look like for us to somehow simultaneously harmonize a loving intention with a forceful
that's right
no.
Right, because I get anxious too. I mean, I can imagine things degenerating to the point where violence is inevitable, and I think that would be dreadful, clearly. And so I would like to see people engage as much as we can right now. Because we can be awfully complacent and wait for the worst in a way, and why do that? And like, I'm very passionate about people voting. Not everybody is, and I've gotten slammed for that too, you know, but I think it's in a way, it's like the closest thing in a social political system to the Buddha saying everybody has innate dignity. Everybody has a worth. Everybody has a voice, in other words. And we need to exercise that. And we need to protect that and see if we can protect it for as many people as we can. And people need to do it. You know, you can't, like, just complain. You know, everything has to move in the direction of it's not right. You know, things aren't right when people are hurting so badly. And we've got to each do something about it. And it will look differently for everybody, which is why I included art, for example, and creativity and things like that. But however it looks, I think we need that ignited.
Can we just, it's an hour and I know you got a dinner, but just very quickly, when is your dinner, by the way?
5:30.
What time is it now?
4:15.
Okay.
That's okay. No, we can definitely do whatever you want to.
Okay, thank you. So creativity, you're you've got to be one of the most prolific people I know. You've written so many books. You're always speaking. You're always doing retreats. And how are you finding the inspiration and the discipline? Like, where is it coming from? When are you writing? Do you write every day?
Well, I just turned in the final edit. Oh, no, I just cut some back today. I thought I turned in the final edits of my next book last Wednesday. I did just get a few queries back today that I had to answer. And so now it's done. I think it's in. I have learned that, you know, I usually sign a book contract, but I get booked in teaching so far ahead of time that I'm then scrambling to find time to write. And I've learned that doesn't really work as well as just doing what sensible people do, which is not traveling so much when you have a book and being more present. I do kind of write every day.
Do you have a practice around writing?
Most of my practice is based on sitting, meditation, and then writing, for example, because what I found, like, I wrote this book called Faith, which was really like my faith journey, so it was very personal. And I found that the best writing I did was two times a day. One was when I first woke up in the morning. It's like the censor had not woken up yet. And the other was just after I meditated, because I don't sit down and think, my biggest weakness in writing is structure, which is really relationship. How does this relate to that? Because it all relates in my mind.
Right.
And so the editorial criticism I received right from the beginning was, how'd you get from here to there?
Huh.
I just went. I don't know.
Right.
And but when I sit, and I'm not trying to figure out how does this relate to that, but I'm just creating some space, and it's open, and it's a space where a lot of possibilities can emerge. And that's when structure comes to me. Oh, this relates to this in this way.
Okay. So when you're sitting, you don't feel like, you know, because sometimes when I'm sitting, I'll have moments of inspiration. I'm like, oh, that's a funny joke. Or, oh, that. And then I think, what are you doing? You're meditating right now. This isn't a place to be contemplating what your next podcast is going to be about or what you're going to say. You should be quiet and let that float on. So it's okay.
It's okay. Of course, it's okay. But, I try not to deliberate on it, like elaborate it and figure it, because then I'm thinking about India or something, before I know it. But it's like I must have a compartment I feel in my brain where I just say, remember that. And I remember it. Some people actually keep a pad of paper near them and they'll just write down that idea. But I don't like to do that because I figure I'll just spend all the time writing, knowing me. So
this is oh my God. This is such a cool thing to hear. It's so funny how David Nickturn and I work together with meditation. He has taught me a lot. And before I started sitting with him, I thought you had to be in pain. Like you lotus position back, but there was an agony that needed to be there. Yeah. And also don't move. Like stay completely stone cold still, like you're being stalked or something. So my meditation, which I didn't do that much, was essentially like the most ridiculous, contorted, frozen, paralyzed thing. And I remember when he told me, you can, if you have an itch, you can itch it. If you need to adjust, you could adjust. But the pad, whoa, now that's revolutionary.
But if it's too much, then try what I do, which is just like mentally put it in a place where you're going to file it in effect and then go on.
I get the feeling I've smoked more weed than you have.
Very possible. I'm a child of the 60s, so I don't want to say that. I went to college in 1968.
That compartment you're talking about in my brain is like a collapsed mine. I think the pad would be...
Okay, maybe the pad.
P.S. No offense, marijuana friends out there. You know what I'm saying, though. I know it's not fashionable to say maybe it affects our memory. I've done other drugs, too. I also fell off my bike when I was a kid. Anyway, the point is the pad sounds amazing, but I feel like we should close on not just talking about your process, but in your book, the idea that your art, your writing, your comedy, your whatever particular mode of creative expression, it might be a little bit more important than you think it is as far as our planet goes.
Well, I think it's crucially important. And one of the things I went into, because I do have this whole section on accepting joy, and it's hard when you're aware, you're concerned. I mean, you keep bringing up other people's children, when you're aware of how hard things can be.
Yes.
It's very hard to accept the joy, but we need a sense of renewal. We need some peace. We need a break. Right. So we can then marshal some energy and try to make a difference. And so I've really long been fascinated by the question of that in art, because I've always been asked, like, I've had painters say to me, I don't know if I want to meditate because I'll lose my ability to make art, which has to come from this anguish inside of me. And that's a very Western notion of where art, great art, comes from. So I talk about in the book about this panel I saw once at Emory University with the Dalai Lama, and it was actually Alice Walker and Richard Gere on the panel. And that was the first question. Like, doesn't art have to come from great suffering?
Yeah.
And Alice Walker said she once believed that. That's sort of what she was taught. But she felt as she got happier, her art was getting better. And Richard Gere talked about being like an angry young man. And then the Dalai Lama was so interesting. He said, basically, people are always taking me to look at things and say, isn't that beautiful? And he said, in the Tibetan view, a work of art has worth depending on what happened to the artist in the act of creating it. So if an artist got more enlightened or kinder or more balanced as they created, more aware as they created the work of art, that made it great art.
Wow. That's the most beautiful thing I ever heard. Wow. You have got me tearing up over that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm so happy.
That's the metric.
Yeah.
We're torturing ourselves over here because the metric is how much money did you make? Mm-hmm. Or was it, did it get out? Or how many?
That's right.
Whoa. The metric isn't even, did it like bring world peace, or did it create social change out in the world? It's how are you?
That's right.
When you finish.
That's right.
Wow. Well, if the Dalai Lama is correct, then this was a very good podcast. Because that's like, thank you for that.
Yeah, well, thank him. You know, so.
I can't wait to read your book.
Yeah, thank you.
When's it coming out?
June 2nd.
June 2nd. It's right around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah, it's already available for pre-sale, which is remarkable.
And God, friends, please, I don't mean to go all telethon here. My eyes are now watering from what I just heard, which is my mind is blown. So I'm gonna do a telethon. It actually helps a lot if you do pre-sale, I've heard.
Yeah, it does.
Do the pre-sale. Obviously, this is a book you should read. I'm gonna be reading it. Go do it right now for Sharon, because I'm sure you get a litany of podcast requests every day. And thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Yeah, I'm so delighted to see you.
I'm so delighted to see you too. And thanks for what you do.
Thank you.
It's been really, really wonderful chatting with you. Wow. Friends, that's Real Change, Mindfulness to Heal Ourselves in the World by Sharon Salzberg. All the links you need to find that are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Sharon Salzberg. A big thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. I've got to head out and put razor wire and machine gun turrets around the side of my compound, but we will be back next week. If you love the DTFH, don't forget to subscribe to us over at patreon.com/DTFH and give us a nice rating on iTunes, won't you? I love y'all. Stay safe. This will blow over soon, and we'll be back to normal before you know it. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.